So my talk today is based on this recently published book, The New Commonwealth Model of Constitutionalism, which is going around that direction. And my talk is divided into three parts. So in the first part, I will make a few introductory comments about terminology, the basic claims, and the structure of the book. And then in the second part, I'll present the main arguments from the three chapters that I circulated, which deal with the theory part of this new model. And then finally, I'll say a few words about the second part of the book, which is how this new model is working in practice in the various countries that have adopted it. And I will try and speak as slowly as I can, which probably will speed up. So both France and the United Kingdom have a long tradition of resisting the institution of judicial review of legislation that swept through Western Europe after 1945. As you know, of course, eventually France created a unique alternative or the most minimalist form of judicial review by having constitutional review but not judicial review, constitutional council without judges, and judicial constitutional review only until recently before lois were promulgated. Right? So a very, very minimalist form of judicial review. My book explores a more recent experiment in the United Kingdom and some other Commonwealth jurisdictions to create another lesser version of judicial review that continues to resist the dominant contemporary paradigm of constitutionalism around the world. So in that sense, France and the United Kingdom continue a tradition of resistance to full judicial review that most other countries have adopted. So let me just explain the title of my book. The New Commonwealth Model of Constitutionalism is the term I use for a general approach which has been adopted in five recent bills of rights in English-speaking countries. So they are the Canadian Charter of Fundamental Rights and Freedoms of 1982, the New Zealand Bill of Rights Act of 1990, the United Kingdom's Human Rights Act of 1998, and most recently, two Australian sub-national units. The Australian Capital Territory enacted a Human Rights Act in 2004, and the State of Victoria enacted a Charter of Human Rights in 2006. And so these are the five bills of rights that I think have adopted this model. And I call it the New Commonwealth Model because it contrasts with the old Commonwealth Model of legislative supremacy by establishing a codified Bill of Rights. Of course, English constitutionalism dislikes codification of any sort, so having a codified Bill of Rights is new. And also enforcing this codified Bill of Rights through judicial power of constitutional review. So that's what's new about this model. On the other hand, it also permits the British Parliament, or any of the parliaments in these five jurisdictions, to have the final word on what the law of the land is. I call it the Commonwealth, so that's why it's the new Commonwealth model, as distinct from the old one. I call it the Commonwealth model because it's the place of origin of this model. And so here I'm just using a normal characteristic of comparative law. You know, think of the American versus the European model of judicial review. So I call it the Commonwealth model because it's in Commonwealth countries that this model has so far been adopted. But there are a few other people have subsequently given other names to this model, and it's possible that you are familiar with some of the other names. They include weak form judicial review, the dialogue model, which is very popular actually in Britain and Australia as the term for this model. I continue to think that my term is better, but you know, I'm an academic. But they are essentially all talking about the same model, right? They're just different terms. So the book makes two basic claims. The first claim is that The new Commonwealth model is an experiment, and it's definitely an experiment, in a new and distinct third model of constitutionalism. So until recently, there was a clear dichotomy in basic choice of constitutional structure. Either legislative supremacy, along the lines of the traditional British or French principles of parliamentary sovereignty, of loi as the supreme embodiment of the popular will, or judicial supremacy as first established in the United States. Under legislative supremacy, of course, courts have no power to review legislation for infringing rights, because rights are not generally conceptualized as constraints on legislative power. They're conceptualized as the product of legislative power. By contrast, under judicial supremacy, one or all courts, or possibly other independent institutions, are empowered to enforce the entrenched higher law, constitution, and Bill of Rights by invalidating incompatible legislation, against whose decisions legislatures have no power to act by ordinary majority. They are powerless in the face of a judicial decision. Since 1945, and especially since 1989, the so-called third wave of democratization, there's been a massive switch from one side of this dichotomy, from legislative supremacy to the other side, to judicial or constitutional supremacy. Every new democracy since 1989 has established a constitutional court and a power of judicial review. So that's very much been the dominant model. However, since 1982, constitutional developments in this small group of Commonwealth jurisdictions that I've just mentioned have attempted to institutionalize a new and distinct intermediate approach between the two choices of legislative or judicial supremacy. And in fact, this new model is in practice now the most common alternative to judicial or constitutional supremacy, since, in the words of Mark Tushnet from Harvard, the model of legislative supremacy has mostly been withdrawn from sale. It's no longer available for sale. So this really is, in practice, the most common alternative. Now, I want to make clear that I think this model, although it originated in the Commonwealth, it is a general model of constitutionalism potentially available anywhere. Right? It's not limited to Commonwealth countries. It's not limited to common law countries. It's not limited to legislative supremacy jurisdictions. It's not limited to parliamentary systems. As evidence of that, I've been invited to Brazil to give a talk later this next year, because many academics in Brazil believe that this model could be a relevant basis for constitutional reform in that country, because at least some people think there is excessive judicial power in Brazil at the moment. Brazil obviously is a civil law, presidential, judicial supremacy jurisdiction. So I think that exemplifies that it is a very general model that ought to have a place on the menu of constitutional design options that drafters of constitutions can select if they think, you know, on balance, it's a good idea for them. And I should say that Brazil is not the only country outside the Commonwealth countries that has expressed interest in this model. Turkey, for example, is another country, although it is a parliamentary system, at least now. It's in the middle of changing to a presidential or a more presidential system. So that's the first claim in the book, that this is a new and distinct general model of constitutionalism. The second basic claim in the book is that it's not only a distinct model, but at least within mature, established democracies, there's a strong, perhaps even compelling normative case for this model as compared with the other two. I think that outside mature or established democracies, again, I think this is a general model. I think that it might be useful in some new and transitional democracies. Many of you will know that in the last year or two, there have been so-called backlashes against constitutional courts in a number of countries around the world, including Hungary, in part South Africa, Romania, in Egypt. And it's possible that this model could help to lessen the tensions that have existed between judiciaries and political institutions in a number of new and transitional democracies. But I don't argue in the book that this is a compelling model for new and transitional democracies. I simply argue that it's an available model. I do argue that there is a very strong normative case for this model in mature or established democracies. And to support these two claims, the book develops the theory and explores the practice of the model as it's operating in these five jurisdictions. And what I hope to do, or what I hope I have done in the book, is to present the model in a more systematic and comprehensive way than it's been presented before. And in particular, in the theory sections that you have, the three chapters that I circulated, in the first chapter that you have, chapter two, I attempt to clarify the conceptual components of the new model, to explain what's new about the new model. In chapter three, I present the normative case for the new model, which again, I think, is a compelling case for established democracies. And in the third chapter that you have, which is chapter four of the book, I attempt to develop an internal normative account as to how the model ought best operate. What is the best way for this model to operate in theory? And then on the practice side, the second part of the book explores in some detail how the model is working in each of the five jurisdictions. And it is different. It's a general model, but it's been institutionalized in somewhat different ways in each of the five jurisdictions. So that's the introductory part of my talk. And what I plan to do now is to turn to say a few words about the main arguments in the theory part of the book, which again is chapters 2, 3, and 4 of the book. So chapter 2 asks, what is new about, what is the new model, and what exactly is new about it? Right, so I attempt to present the conceptual apparatus of the new model. And I argue that, in essence, the new Commonwealth model is a novel combination of two techniques for protecting rights. And those two techniques are the ex ante technique of what I call political rights review, which I will explain in a minute, and the ex post technique of weak form judicial review. So let me just say a few words about political rights review. Political rights review aims to improve the legislative process from the perspective of sensitivity towards rights. So the idea is that to the extent that the major argument for judicial review, I think, has always been that legislatures cannot be trusted fully to protect the rights of citizens, and in particular the rights of a minority of citizens, the aim here is to improve the legislative process by requiring Parliament and executives to formally consider the rights implications of proposed legislation. And each of the five jurisdictions has a formal process for executive and legislative consideration of the rights implications of proposed legislation. And that is a very important part of the model. That's why I call it political rights review, because the political institutions are required to consider seriously the rights implications of their proposed legislation. The second part is weak form judicial review. And weak form judicial review contrasts with the conventional strong form judicial review. And here I am using Mark Tushnet's distinction between strong form and weak form judicial review, but I don't think it's a good label for the whole model, because political rights review is an important component of the model, as far as I'm concerned. It contrasts most generally because, although in all of these jurisdictions, courts are empowered to engage in constitutional review, to assess the compatibility of legislation with the Bill of Rights, in each of these jurisdictions, the political institutions are not powerless to respond to a court by ordinary majority vote. Most obviously in Canada, under Section 33 of the Canadian Charter, legislatures are empowered to reinstate legislation which the Supreme Court of Canada has invalidated. So that's the most general way, because in each of these jurisdictions, parliaments have the power by ordinary majority vote to disagree with the courts and maintain as law legislation which courts have declared unconstitutional. More specifically, in four of the five jurisdictions, all except Canada, courts do not have the power to invalidate legislation. Instead, they have alternative powers of constitutional review. In particular, they have two types of alternative powers. One is a British invention, which is the Declaration of Incompatibility, which empowers British courts to declare statutes incompatible with the Bill of Rights. But that declaration has no legal effect. The courts are required to apply legislation that they have declared incompatible. What happens is that it puts a political cost on Parliament to amend or repeal a statute, but there is no legal obligation on Parliament to do so. The second technique is a duty on courts to interpret statutes consistently with the Bill of Rights wherever possible. So they can stretch and not apply normal modes of statutory interpretation to try and interpret a statute consistently with rights. But if they can't, if it's impossible to interpret a statute consistently with rights, then the court must apply the statute. So that's in all of the jurisdictions except Canada. So in this way, the new Commonwealth model aims to bring the powers of courts and legislatures into greater balance than under either of the traditional models. Under either of the traditional models, either the legislature has most of the power with respect to rights, or under judicial supremacy, courts have most of the power. The idea here is to bring the power of courts and legislatures with respect to the Bill of Rights into greater balance. It also conceives of courts and legislatures as joint protectors of rights, rather than having one or the other as the exclusive guarantor of rights. And perhaps most distinctively, it separates the power of judicial review from judicial supremacy or finality. I think is one of the distinctive features of the new model. So as a result of the new model, I think there are now two interesting distinctions in comparative constitutional law concerning judicial review. The first is the traditional distinction between the American or the European model, between centralized judicial review in one court or independent institution on the one hand, and decentralized judicial review on the other. That's the traditional distinction which we comparative constitutional lawyers spend a lot of time writing and thinking about. But now there's this second distinction between strong judicial review and weak judicial review. And I think they are cross-cutting distinctions in that there's no conceptual reason why weak judicial review could not apply in either centralized or decentralized systems of judicial review. Again, the fact that they currently apply only in decentralized common law systems of judicial review, I think, is entirely contingent. There's no reason why, in principle, a centralized constitutional court could not be given these powers, these more limited powers of judicial review as a matter of principle. So to summarise here, these two techniques, political rights review and weak form judicial review, combine to create what I think of as four necessary components of the new model. Right? The first is, again, just to summarise, to recap, a codified Bill of Rights. That Bill of Rights does not have to have the status of constitutional law. It can be an ordinary statute, but it is a codified Bill of Rights, which again is unusual in these Commonwealth jurisdictions. And then there are three stages of review. First, by the political institutions before legislation is enacted during the legislative process. Then judicial review of the legislation that's enacted. And finally, the possibility of a further round of political review where the political institutions decide whether or not to enforce a disagreement with the courts. So those are the components of the model. Finally, on this point, I think that the new model suggests that rather than a bipolar world of either legislative supremacy or judicial supremacy, constitutionalism is more of a continuum. There are many positions that are possible on a spectrum. And I, at least, conceive of the spectrum as running from what in the book and in Britain tends to be called political constitutionalism or pure political constitutionalism, which is that any constraints on government are only politically accountable, on the one hand, all the way to the idea of total or pure legal constitutionalism, which has been discussed by some, in particular, German constitutional theorists, in which the Constitution gives the answers to almost all important social conflicts in society. And so I conceive of this spectrum as essentially answering the question, how many important and divisive conflicts in society should be resolved by judicially enforced higher law? I think pure political constitutionalism says the answer is zero. No conflicts in society should be resolved by judicially enforced higher law. It can be enforced by ordinary law, subject to ordinary majority voting by Parliament, but not by judicially enforced higher law. All the way at the other end of the spectrum, again, some people have argued that Germany comes closest to this, is the position that almost all important conflicts in society should be resolved by judicially enforced higher law, leaving relatively little room for discretionary political decision-making. And in between those two poles, I think you have what I call ordinary constitutional supremacy, which leaves more room for discretionary political decision-making, but still resolves some important conflicts in society through judicially enforced higher lawmaking. And then you have the new Commonwealth model, in which no conflicts are definitively resolved by judicially enforced higher law, but they can influence their resolution. So again, I think one of the advantages of this model is that it opens up the conceptual map of the spectrum of constitutionalist options. Again, both for theoretical purposes and also for drafters of new constitutions. So that's chapter two on what the new model is and what's new about it. More briefly, chapter three presents, again, my second basic claim, which is this model has strong normative arguments, in fact, I believe, compelling arguments in established democracies. And the basic argument that I make is that the new Commonwealth model is to forms of constitutionalism what the mixed economy is to forms of economic organization. That's to say, it's a distinct and appealing intermediate position between two purer but flawed extremes. Just as both capitalism and socialism are thought to allocate too much power to either the market or to the collective, and the mixed economy is a better balance between the two, enabling us to get the advantages of both capitalism and socialism while not getting the disadvantages of both. I think the same argument can be made with respect to the new Commonwealth model. And in particular, in the context of pervasive and reasonable disagreements about rights issues that exist in all mature democracies, I think the new model manages to combine the major strengths of constitutional supremacy and legislative supremacy while also eliminating their major weaknesses, again, just like the mixed economy does with respect to the economy. Another way to put this is that it permits a form of proportional representation among the arguments for and against judicial review. So the old choice between legislative supremacy or judicial supremacy meant that, you know, even if you think one is better than the other, unless you think that one is perfect, you know, there are disadvantages of both. But we have to choose one or the other. And so we get the benefits, but we also have the disadvantages of the one we don't choose, plus we lose the benefits of the one we haven't chosen. So that it's a rather crude and not terribly sophisticated choice that we have under the traditional model. By contrast, I think one of the advantages of the new model is that it enables us to more proportionately get the benefits of both models while eliminating the disadvantages. And I attempt to make that argument in Chapter 3. So the new model really combines. Again, it's a hybrid model. It's a mixed system. And so it attempts to combine legal and political decision-making about rights. Again, the competition between legislative and judicial supremacy is significantly about how important should political debate versus legal debate about rights be in society. And again, the new model attempts to combine both political and legal deliberation about rights in a formal sequence. It also attempts to disperse rather than concentrate responsibility for rights in one institution. So again, it disperses power with respect to rights. And it also creates both ex ante and ex post protections of rights. Again, one of the well-known problems with relying on courts is that, you know, many cases under concrete judicial review never get to courts. And, you know, if they're not litigated, rights can be violated for a long time before a court does anything. And very often courts don't ever get involved in many rights issues. Again, one of the advantages of this model is that it provides, through its two constitutive techniques, both ex ante and ex post rights protection. So that's my normative argument in summary in Chapter 3. In Chapter 4, I attempt to develop a normative account of how the model ought best to operate. And here, what I'm trying to do in particular is present an argument as to when it is proper for a legislature to exercise the power that it has under this model of the final word of disagreeing with courts. Because one of the practical problems in some of the jurisdictions that have adopted this model is that there's a sense that it's never appropriate for legislatures to exercise this power. Yes, we know they have the power formally, but really it's never appropriate to disagree with the courts. The political costs of disagreeing with courts are very high. You know, political institutions in these countries are used to obeying their courts. They're not used to disobeying their courts. And it's become quite difficult in some of these countries for legislatures to exercise this power for various reasons. So the main goal of Chapter 4 is to present a normative account of when it is appropriate for legislatures to disagree with courts in the hope that that will both ease the use of this power but also constrain the use of this power. And what I conclude in this chapter is that firstly, when exercising their powers, courts should be respectful towards the political rights review that legislatures have engaged in during the legislative process. But they don't. They shouldn't be overly deferential towards courts. Very often, when we have strong form judicial review, courts are concerned that they don't have a democratic basis for overturning legislative decisions. That concern doesn't exist in this model. It's one of the benefits. Yes, courts might defer to the expertise of legislatures on certain issues, but they do not need to defer on democratic grounds, because the democratic basis exists in the final legislative word after the judicial decision. So that's how courts should act. But more importantly, how should legislatures act? When is it proper for legislatures to exercise their power to disagree with courts and maintain a statute that the courts have declared incompatible with rights? Well, I argue that there are two criteria. The first is a procedural criteria, which is that legislatures must deliberate seriously and in good faith with respect to the relevant rights issue. And to be fair, that has not always happened in exercises so far in the five jurisdictions. Sometimes it has, sometimes it hasn't. But it ought to be understood that legislatures must deliberate seriously on the rights issues involved. The second criterion is a substantive one, which is that the legislative resolution of the rights issue must be within the field of reasonable resolutions of the rights issue. Again, one of the reasons, I think, for this model is that there is pervasive, reasonable disagreement about how to resolve most rights issues under Bills of Rights. And it's within the parameters of reasonable outcomes that I think the legislative power must be exercised. It's not part of this model's normative account to permit legislatures to override courts on the basis of unreasonable rights decisions. It is to permit them to disagree reasonably with courts and to insist on their view. So that concludes the theory part of the book, and I just, in the last few minutes, want to say a few words about the second part of the book, which assesses, in the light of the theory that I've developed, how this model is operating in the five jurisdictions. I don't want to go into detail, but just let me summarise. And in particular, what I try to do here is to address certain sceptical claims that have been made that the new model is really no different from either legislative supremacy or judicial supremacy. That yes, on paper, the powers seem different, but in reality, they're no different. Or a similar claim that even if they are different at the beginning, after a period of time, inevitably, these jurisdictions will revert to either legislative or judicial supremacy. And I want to test that hypothesis in the second part of the book. So very briefly, Canada has a different version of the new model than the other jurisdictions, as I've already mentioned. Canada has a constitutional Bill of Rights. The only difference, formally, between the Canadian Charter of Rights and the German or the United States Constitution is Section 33, this power of parliaments in Canada to override court decisions. Canada has a constitutional Bill of Rights. The Canadian courts have the power to invalidate legislation, but parliaments in Canada have the power to override those judicial decisions under Section 33 of the Charter. I argue in the book that, at least for now, Canada has reverted to de facto judicial supremacy, because it is extremely rare for Canadian parliaments to exercise their power under Section 33 to disagree with courts and to reinstate legislation that courts have declared invalid. The reasons for that are rather complicated, but the fact is that essentially today it's not really a practical political possibility for Canadian parliaments to exercise this power. That may change, but at the moment, I think, it is fair to say that Canada has reverted to de facto judicial supremacy, and despite the attempts of Canadian constitutional scholars to distinguish their system structurally from that of the United States, which is what Canadian scholars generally do all the time, I think at the moment it's unsuccessful. I think that the powers of the Canadian Supreme Court are really a little different from those of the United States Supreme Court. It has the final word as a matter of practice. By contrast, New Zealand has a statutory Bill of Rights. The New Zealand Bill of Rights Act was passed as an ordinary statute, and it does not give the courts power to invalidate statutes, but it gives courts one of the two alternative powers that I've mentioned, that is, the power to interpret statutes consistently with the Bill of Rights whenever it's possible to do so. If it's not possible, New Zealand courts must apply the incompatible statute. And overall, I would say, New Zealand, if the problem in Canada is that rights issues have become too court-centric, everyone, as in the United States, expects the court to answer the rights issue. That's not true in New Zealand. New Zealand has developed a court-influenced but not court-centric approach to the resolution of rights issues. One major example that I discuss in the book, it's a little complex, the facts, but basically New Zealand has a criminal provision that requires anybody who's found in possession of a certain amount of illegal drugs to prove that those drugs were not meant to be sold, that they weren't aiming to deal in those drugs. It's what's known in English as a reverse onus of proof, which is quite unusual. And the New Zealand Supreme Court effectively held that that provision was inconsistent with the right to be presumed innocent. The fact that the defendant has to prove that I'm not in supply of drugs in order to sell them was inconsistent with the right to be presumed innocent in a criminal case. However, the New Zealand Supreme Court was required to apply the statute, even though it was thought that the court held that it was inconsistent with that right. And right now, the New Zealand Parliament is considering whether to amend or repeal the statute. And everybody thinks that the court has put this issue into the political forum, but it is Parliament and the New Zealand government that ultimately will decide this issue, nobody else. And that, to my mind, is a fairly good example of how the new model is supposed to operate in practice. In the United Kingdom, it's also a statutory Bill of Rights. The Human Rights Act of 1998 is an ordinary statute. Again, British courts do not have the power to invalidate a statute, but they have the power to interpret statutes consistently with rights and this novel power of declaring a statute incompatible, which has no legal effect on the continuing operation of the statute. There are many things I could say about the British system in practice. What I will say in my few minutes is that as between the courts and the political branches in Britain, although declarations of incompatibility have no legal consequence, on 26 of 27 occasions when British courts have issued declarations of incompatibility, the British Parliament has amended or repealed that statute. That's led some people to say that's like Canada, right? The courts effectively have the final word. The one example in which so far the British Parliament has not agreed with the courts is the now infamous issue of prisoners' voting rights, which I'm sure some of you are aware of. And it remains entirely uncertain what the British Parliament will do on prisoners' voting rights. Right now, the government has proposed legislation which has three different options, one of which is to continue the blanket ban on prisoners' voting rights, and two other options. And there is now a committee of Parliament which is considering, and it's entirely uncertain which way Parliament will go. The issue in Britain, here as with many of the other cases, is complicated by the existence of the European Court of Human Rights. Because, of course, even though domestically British declarations of incompatibility have no legal effect, of course the European Court of Human Rights in Strasbourg is a different matter, and its decisions are internationally legally binding on the United Kingdom. And, of course, the United Kingdom is currently in violation, right, as the European Court and Commission have made clear, of their obligations under the European Convention. Right? But there is no doubt that but for the European Court, the British Parliament would ignore the British Court that also made a declaration of incompatibility on prisoners' voting rights. So it's not entirely clear that there is de facto judicial supremacy. I would argue that there is a reasonable balance between courts and Parliament under the Human Rights Act in Britain. Let me just conclude. I won't mention Australia in my discussion, but I just want to conclude with a summary of how I see things working out under the new model. I think that it's very hard to argue, although, of course, as academics, some people have argued, I think it's hard to argue that rights are not better protected since these Bills of Rights have been enacted than before. I think that's true in all of these jurisdictions. I think, as I've said, there is a clear reversion to judicial supremacy in Canada, and, although I didn't mention it, there is a clear reversion to legislative supremacy in Australia. However, New Zealand and the United Kingdom have, I think, a better balance, as the model suggests, between judicial and legislative power with respect to rights. I think the experience in New Zealand and Australia makes clear that there is a difference between strong form and weak form judicial review in the way that some people have doubted. Australian courts in particular have exercised their powers very weakly. And there really is a difference between strong form and weak form judicial review. It's also clear that the very same powers, judicial powers in particular, can work out differently. So courts in Britain and Australia have essentially the same powers of constitutional review, the powers to declare statutes incompatible and the power to interpret statutes consistently with rights. But they have operated very, very differently. The Australian courts have not used their powers, whereas the British courts have used their powers. As I've said, on 26 of 27 occasions, they've made declarations of incompatibility. So again, some people have argued that these judicial powers have a fixed weight. But that's not true. It depends very much on the context. The very same powers are operating very differently in the United Kingdom and in Australia. And to finish, I want to stress that this model is an experiment. It's fairly new. It's much too soon, I think, to draw definitive conclusions. It's an experiment as to whether it's possible to have greater balance of power between courts and political institutions and effective protection of rights, as to whether judicial power can be increased without having judicial supremacy, whether by changing procedures and political costs, legislatures can be trusted with greater responsibilities with respect to rights. In short, whether a middle ground is possible. Now, it's very, very early days, so it's perfectly possible that the experiment will fail and the predictions of the sceptics will turn out to be true. On the other hand, again, as I think in United Kingdom and New Zealand, those predictions are not yet turning out to be true. And I think, as I've said, the model is normatively attractive if it works in practice. So it is, I think, in comparative constitutional law, a very interesting experiment, even if ultimately it turns out to fail. Voilà. Merci de votre attention.